So I'm going to just roll down here to the notes on natural law, and I just added one paragraph. We were talking the other day about natural law theory, and are there natural ethics in people? Are there natural laws about how people behave with one another? And if so, then maybe we should abide by those natural laws. So I read this interesting article that I have now put on your reading list, and it's basically by a primatologist, if I said that right, a person who studies primates. So the author of this article is one of the leading primatologists in the world, and he's written a number of interesting books. And he sort of points out the following. If we want to truly learn about, well, let's make an assumption. Let's assume that you believe in evolution. You don't have to believe, Ralph, but just assume you believe, okay, for the moment. Now, if you believe in evolution, that means what? Us and the higher apes, the gorillas and the chimps, pretty much evolved together until very recently. So what's natural for us must be very close to what's natural for them. So if we're thinking about what is human nature, maybe one place to look for human nature is to look at chimps and to look at gorillas. And maybe their nature won't be quite as human as our nature. But if we have certain natural ethics, certain types of ways we deal with each other, certain restrictions with how we deal with each other, then maybe we should look for at least primitive forms of that amongst chimpanzees and gorillas. And there's been a lot of studies about how chimps and how gorillas interact within the group, intra-group, and between groups, inter-group. And you can ask all sorts of interesting questions, like, do chimps and gorillas sympathize? Do they have empathy for one another? How do they act with other members of their own group versus bands of other chimpanzees, for example? What do those words mean, by the way? Sympathy. What's the difference between sympathy and empathy? If I have sympathy for you, what does that mean?
It means I can say that's probably horrible for you. So with empathy, you're like, I know, I feel that's horrible for you.
Maybe. I guess what I would have said was, along those lines, I think I would have said that I can have, for example, sympathy for a dog, but it's harder for me to have empathy for a dog. Sympathy in the sense that I feel sorry for what's happening to it. If you have empathy, that means you're what? You can sort of put yourself in their shoes. You know, you can put yourself in their shoes and it can be a positive thing. You know, you can empathize with their accomplishments. But you could also empathize with their misery. Do animals show sympathy? Do animals show empathy?
They have pain responses. Other animals react to
it. Doesn't also depend on the intelligence?
Yeah, now we're talking about chimpanzees now and gorillas.
I know, but aren't apes supposed to be more more advanced in that brain activity than some other species in that? I mean, I think.
Well, you would think so. I mean, on an evolutionary scale, we would say what? We would say that where are we most likely to find animals that are nearly as intelligent as us, right? The ones that are most closely linked to us genetically, which would be the chimpanzees and the gorillas. Do they have ethics? If they have natural ethics, we probably have natural ethics. Or are they just robots-like who just react in a certain way just because it's built into their system?
And do we do that?
Well, then that raises the question, is that what we do? I mean, a lot of us like to think that we are consciously good or bad, and it's not just some sort of knee-jerk reaction that's built into our genes. But then at the same time, we might turn around and say, well, but animals don't do that. Sometimes they look like they care about other members of the group, but they don't really care. They're just evolved to act in a certain way because it was good for their genes, for example. It would make it more likely that the genes of the band would survive. Now, if you make that argument, though, there's an interesting aside to that argument. If you say, well, their motivation or lack of motivation for behaving ethically has a completely different basis than ours, then you'd say, well, why the hell is that, since genetically they're so closely related to us and we evolved together? So if we have ethics, maybe they have ethics as well, and maybe we can learn something about their ethics or our ethics from observing them. I mean, if you think about chimpanzees in particular, they do what? They live in groups. There's lots of cooperation within the group. There's lots of indications, at least they behave in ways that suggests that they show sympathy towards other members of the group. They behave in ways that suggest they have empathy for other members of the group. Do chimps kill each other, or do only people do that?
Chimps
do it. They're more likely to do it to a chimp in what? Another group, foreign chimps. They're more likely to kill a foreign chimp than a chimp that belongs to their group. But they also will sometimes kill within the group. That's usually because of what?
I've seen a couple of times. I saw this video of some male chimp in a society kill a baby of some female. And he grabbed the babies and beat him on a tree.
One argument for that would be that maybe the chimp thought that this baby was the offspring of another male, and this was a threat to him being the big kahuna. I mean, usually when chimps kill chimps within a group, it's usually a male who's doing the killing. It's often killing another male in a fight for who's going to be the top chimp, if you'd like. Often when they fight for dominance, though, it usually doesn't end up in anybody killing anyone, but sometimes it does.
What time is it?
Thank you. So, just another slight take on what we mean by natural law theory. So, utilitarianism. It comes from the word utilis, which means useful. And as we've already said, what? Utilitarians equate good with pleasure, happiness, contentment, that sort of thing. And they equate bad with pain and suffering. So something is good in a moral or ethical sense for utilitarian if it gives pleasure. And something is bad from the perspective of a utilitarian if it causes pain or suffering. The first question we always have to ask is what? Whose pain, whose pleasure, whose suffering, whose contentment? Who counts, who doesn't count? Now, most modern day utilitarians would only include people. But actually the guys who started utilitarianism, Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill, they thought it should apply to all sentient beings. There's a little footnote there. What do we mean by sentient beings? And we've used the term in different ways at different times in this class over the last couple weeks. What they meant was feeling pleasure or pain. So Bentham and John Stuart Mill thought that anybody or anything that felt pleasure or pain or was capable of feeling pleasure or pain was in fact, did have moral standing, was a member of society. Now, sometimes, just to contrast it, sometimes people use the word sentient to mean that plus you're consciously aware of yourself, your surroundings, and the distinction between the two. You're consciously aware of the fact that there's a you, and you're different than me, and you're different than that desk. In other words, to have a consciousness in some sense of the word. Now, what are the implications of utilitarianism? Well, if we have a society that only has one person, and that person knows what he or she likes, the implications are very simple. What's good is what gives that person pleasure, or that individual pleasure. What's bad is what causes them unhappiness or suffering. Things get a hell of a lot more complicated, though, if we're talking about a group of individuals. So we have a group, and all the individuals in the group are members of society. Now, if we can think of something that makes every member of the group better off and makes no member of the group worse off, given that we all agree on how the group should be defined, a utilitarian would say that that's what? That's a good thing. We have a concept like that in economics, right? If we can talk about something, a reallocation that makes some members of society better off and makes no other members worse off, we call that a what? A Pareto improvement. And we say that that's a good thing. But the problem is, for lots of different things that we might do, things that make some members of society better off, they also make some other members worse off. So now we're into this happiness calculus. Then the utilitarian would say, well, we've got to count up everyone's benefits and everyone's costs. We've got to count up all the pleasures. We've got to count up all the pains. And if the pleasure is greater than the pain, then it's a good thing. In other words, utilitarians would say, another common term for us, we want to maximize net benefits. We want to undertake the action that maximizes net benefits, and any action that maximizes net benefits is good, in a moral or ethical sense of the word, and any action that doesn't is bad.
How do you quantify a qualitative, good and bad?
And that's the issue, right? How does one add up pleasures and pains across the members of society? Well, the utilitarians are taking as given here. I mean, we can be a utilitarian and define society in different ways. So let's assume at the moment we have decided who's a member of society, and we've decided that it's everyone in this room, and everyone who's not in this room is not a member of society. So we're going to undertake some action. And it's going to make some of us better off and some of us worse off. So, a utilitarian, Bentham, for example, or John Stuart Mill, believed that at least someday it would be possible to add up everyone's benefits and everyone's costs, add up everyone's pleasure and everyone's pain. Now, they also said that every member of society, everyone with equal standing, should be counted equally. So, if I and a pig were both members of society, then pain to the pig should count equally with my pain. And the pig's pleasures should count equally to my pleasures. So in utilitarian, there's a notion of equal. But also there's a notion of what? We have to be able to add these things up. So that means what? My pain and my pleasure has to be commensurate, comparable with your pain and your pleasure. Those guys believe that you could do that. A lot of people now don't. Another difficulty with utilitarianism is that of comparing happiness amongst different people. Many of the early utilitarians hoped that happiness could somehow be measured quantitatively and compared across individuals through felicitous calculus. Felicity is from the Latin or the Italian. Felicity means happiness, basically. So, happiness calculus. Oxymoron, right? No such thing as happy calculus. A lot of people now say that my pain and my pleasure is not commensurate or comparable with yours. But those people believe that you could, in fact, do that. If you click on that little blue thing, calculus, you'll actually kind of see the formula that Bentham had in mind about how he was going to literally add all this stuff up. They all should be equal. We all should get equal weight, all members of society. As we pointed out numerous times, they're consequentialists, utilitarians. So if the benefits to you from the parents of killing the kid are greater than the pain and suffering the kid would incur, then a utilitarian would say that increases the net benefits to society and kill the kid. It doesn't matter what your intent is. Think about a case like the following. Let's say we have somebody who, we talked about this the other day, just for the fun of it, killed the baby Hitler. No idea what Hitler was going to become, didn't care what Hitler was going to become, they just like to kill babies. Now, a utilitarian might say what? Even though the person had really bad motives, since the consequences of killing him before he did all those terrible things was good, then that was a good act from a utilitarian's point of view.
And the problem with that is there's no way to know who that kid would probably become when they're killing.
True.
Whether you tell Penny would ever know about that, so there's no way.
No, but if you came to a utilitarian now and said, well, if somebody had done this to Hitler, so Hitler would have never happened, you give him this hypothetical and you say, was that a good thing that he did it or a bad thing, even though the person did it for terrible reasons? A utilitarian would probably say it was a good thing.
It would have been a good thing if it happened.
Yeah.
But at the time, the utilitarian would say it was a bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know how you're going to turn out.
Yeah, so you can't.
Right. Well, but maybe that's why we execute people sometimes, right? Maybe that's why we keep sex offenders in jail after they serve their sentences or make them sign up on some list, because we punish them because, or constrict them, not because of what they've done, but because
what they might do.
Jeb?
I'm just thinking, if this guy killed 10,000 babies, and then he killed Hitler, and then killing Hitler saved like, what, 20,000 or more of the Holocaust, wouldn't this guy's benefit be like net 10,000 lives? He's actually such a boon to society that...
So by killing this guy, he saved 10,000 people, or he saved...
20,000.
How many Jewish people died in concentration camps?
Yeah. And it doesn't matter that he killed 10,000 babies already. He's still like a saint.
I guess so. Now, you know, we should point something out here.
Let's say he killed somebody else.
Somebody at the end of this course is going to go, I thought it was going to be about economics, and all the course is about is barbecuing babies, right? Killing dogs and barbecuing babies. Well, the point is that what? The way we really understand things is we take them and we do what with them? We just push them kind of to the limit. You know, it's really easy to say, I believe in utilitarianism. But then you should ask, well, what kind of things could utilitarianism advocate? And do I really believe in those things? Do I really think those things are good? And if you don't, then you're not really a utilitarian.
I mean, what if it was your baby? Then, I mean, probably if it was Mill's baby, it would have become Hitler. He probably would say, don't kill it, please. But if all your baby does is scream, then maybe it has no value at all. Don't say,
Does all this have anything to do with you? Does all this have anything to do with that fancy word utility? And what we assume about utility? Utilitarians basically assume that we can quantitatively measure happiness and compare it across people. To do that, we have to be able to measure it, and we have to assume what? That your utility has what's called cardinal properties. So that we can say stuff like, the utility you get from this is twice as much as the utility he gets from that, or you get twice as much utility from this as from that. And then he gets, like, you get 10 units and 5 units, and he gets 7 units and 3 units from those two things. So if we had to choose for the first one that you both like better, we'd get more utility to give it to you because you got 10 units and you only got 7. To do that, utility has to have cardinal properties that are comparable across individuals. That's not what most economists believe today. Most economists believe today, and we're going to talk about this more, that people only have ordinal preferences. They can rank bundles, but they're not capable of saying this bundle is twice as good as that bundle. At least that's what economists typically assume. Now, there's a short step from maximizing net benefits to saying, oh, we should do, the utilitarian would advocate doing things if the gain to the gainers in money terms is greater than the loss to the losers. When we talk about net benefits, we're very close to talking about benefit cost analysis, which we typically do what? We typically do in monetary units. If the gains to the gainers in dollars is greater than the loss to the losers, what does that mean? Does that mean the net benefits to society go up if we do it? Does it? It does if dollars is the correct way to measure benefits across people and costs across people.
Done a really good job of monetizing your but doing a really good job is impossible.
Well, let's back up for a sec. Utilitarians thought everyone should count equally. If we do a benefit cost analysis, who counts more in the benefit cost calculus? A rich person or a poor person? A rich person. They've got a greater willingness to pay because they have more money.
Okay.
So that would suggest that maybe measuring it in dollars isn't necessarily going to tell you what maximizes net benefits in the truest sense of the word. Now, a lot of economists would say, well, you can put things in dollars, and dollars are cardinal, but if people only have preferences that are ordinal, so what? So let's take this back to Pareto for a second. What did Pareto say? He defined a bunch of different things. He defined Pareto improvements, and he said, if we can do something that makes some members of society better off without making any other members worse off, that's a Pareto improvement, and that's a good thing. So let's say we had that rule for deciding between good and bad. So we look at an action, and whatever action we look at, if it makes some members of society better off and no one worse off, we say it's a good thing. Is that rule going to give us very much guidance about what to do in the real world? Occasionally it will, because occasionally we're going to come across some action that doesn't hurt anyone and makes some members of society better off. But a lot of actions aren't like that. So what if we have an action that makes some members better off and other members worse off? But what if the gain to the gainers in dollars is greater than the loss to the losers? What do we call that? Not a Pareto improvement, but we call it a what? We call it a potential Pareto improvement. Because there's what? There's the potential for the gainers to compensate the losers such that what? Such that no one is worse off. So if we're thinking about some action, and I'm willing to pay $10 to make it happen, and you're willing to pay $3 to stop it from happening, so the gain to the gainer is 10, the loss to the loser is 3, that's not a Pareto improvement. Why? Because if we do it, I'm better off and you're worse off. But it's a potential Pareto improvement in what sense?
If you pay him $4, you'd both be happier.
Yeah, if I gave you $4, then we'd both be happier. Or if I gave you 3 of the 10, you wouldn't be any worse off and I would be better off. Now, if the compensation actually takes place, then it becomes a what? It becomes a Pareto improvement. If something is a Pareto improvement, does that mean it's good? Is society better off if we do things that are Pareto improvements?
If you actually follow through the compensation scheme, so that you're not...
Yeah, but no. If it's a potential, but we don't follow through with the compensation.
It comes as an equity, I know.
Is utilitarianism the same thing as majority rule? Majority rule says it's good if the majority likes it, right? We should do it if the majority passes it. Would majority rule always agree with utilitarianism in terms of net benefits? No. You know, what if the benefits to a minority were very great and the cost to everyone else, there was a cost to everyone else, but it was small? Utilitarianism would say do it. Majority voting would say don't do it. So often we confuse those two things, but they're not the same. You know this term we often hear, diminishing marginal utility, where we say you get a certain amount of utility from the first unit, and then the second unit you still get a positive amount, but a declining amount. Shots of tequila, for example, and at some point you start barfing and it actually goes negative. Well, that's a very cardinal concept. If all you believed in was ordinal utility, you could never talk about marginal utility. It wouldn't exist. But if we assume we believe in cardinal utility, an easy step from there is to say, well, it's probably the case that we have diminishing marginal utility. So let's think about a utilitarian here. If everyone counts equally, we can compare utilities across people, and we have diminishing marginal utility. What would a utilitarian say about redistributing income? Let's say we had a poor person and a rich person. They'd say what? Your first million gives you more pleasure than your 100th million. Or your first 10 grand gives you more pleasure than your 100th 10 grand. And if we want to treat everyone equally, it would say what? It would say if you took 10 grand away from a rich person, and you gave it to a poor person, that would probably do what? That would probably increase social welfare, net benefits. So utilitarians are often described as people who want to count everyone equally, and that's true, but one implication of that is often they would argue for redistributing wealth. Jeff?
I was thinking, can't there be marginal utility with ordinal utility? Realist, that you say that we can't just make a choice.